This is Dan Austin. This will be an interview with Dan Ozark. The date is Friday, January the 10th, 1992. I'm at the home of Mr. Ozark in Vero Beach, Florida. This recording is the property of the National Baseball Hall of Fame. First, Mr. Ozark, thank you very much for consenting for this interview, and as we shared some thoughts about that before we began taping it. If you'd give me your name and where you were born and what year, sir.
My name is Daniel Leonard Ozark. I was born in Buffalo, New York, November 26, 1923.
And Ozark, is that a Polish name?
That's a shortened Polish name.
Okay.
My father's name was Orzechowski, O-R-Z-E-C-H-O-W-S-K-I. And when I started high school, they butchered the name, so he just changed it to Ozark. And okay. It became quite a famous name in the newspapers because of a baseball column they had on Ozark Ike.
And that was the column, the name of the column?
That was the name of the column, and we had no idea that Ozark Ike was a baseball hero, you know, in way back in Texas. That's where I think it originated, in the Texas League. And my dad didn't know it. I didn't know it. And why he chose Ozark, I'll never know, but he did.
And, of course, that kind of became your nickname, too, as you went up the ranks.
Yep.
Ozark Ike, and being in the Midwest, I remember, you know, the Missouri and Arkansas Ozarks, but anyway, you got it anglicized,
right.
That was less than a mouthful.
And how.
And your wife is also from Buffalo?
My wife is also from Buffalo. Her name is Virginia. Like everybody calls her Jenny, and mother of two. I have a son, Dwayne, spelled D-W-A-I-N, and daughter, Darlene.
Okay. And
so everybody's a D.
Everybody's a D. And everybody lives in the area here now?
Yes, we have this is kind of an Ozark complex. My son next door and my daughter and her husband about a half a mile down the road.
I think of you principally as a Dodger, although you did manage the Phillies there. But I think anybody knows baseball things well. Danny Ozark and the Dodgers go like paper and glue together. And you were first signed by the Dodgers, a scout by the name of Dick Fisher, if I remember correctly, if my reading is correct.
That's right, Dan. Actually, Dick Fisher didn't sign me. He was a scout, kind of a bird dog scout. Heinie Groh was the man that really scouted me, and then eventually gave his report to the Brooklyn Dodgers at that time. This was in 1942, and I was signed by Dick Fisher, who was a bird dog scout, owned a sporting goods store in Buffalo, New York, and just a great baseball buff is what he was. At that particular time, that's what everybody was doing.
Yeah.
This is a part-time sideline.
So they had other jobs, and they might do that on the...
Well, the scouts at that time got paid by the player's advancement. You started off in Class D, and if you went to C, they got $50. If you went to A, maybe they got another $50, and so on and so forth. And if they reached the major leagues, maybe they got...
Kind of like a pyramid system.
Yeah, right, right.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's the way bird dogs worked, and regular scouts actually worked for a salary.
Okay, where did he find you? I'm sure in Buffalo.
Have
you been playing high school ball?
High school baseball.
Play American Legion ball?
American Legion. Not Little League at that time. It was like a pony league. Little League wasn't in existence way back then.
Yeah.
But American Legion baseball and high school. And then played a lot of semi-pro baseball. Mm-hmm. I was like 14 years old, and I was playing with guys who were 21 and 22 years old already.
You grew up in a hurry.
Yeah, my dad loved baseball. He was a pretty good ball player himself. Never signed as a professional, but he played, and he was a better basketball player than a baseball player. And my secondary sport was baseball. My number one sport was basketball.
So you gained your height pretty much in high school, and...
Yeah.
Someone your size was a tall kid in high school in those days.
I was probably about 5'10", 5'11".
That's a good size kid.
When I graduated.
You're about 6'2".
And I was a second baseman at that time.
Oh, you were?
I signed as a second baseman. And then went into the service in 43 and came out in 45 in December. And came out about 6'3", weighing 195 pounds. Even though I served in Europe in the ETO, and when I came back, Brooklyn had changed hands, where Branch Rickey became the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers. Prior to that, when I first signed, Larry McPhail was the owner.
That's right.
And
Branch was the GM.
Yes. So when I come out, they put me at shortstop. I'm here 6'3", 195-pound shortstop. And we came down to spring training in Daytona Beach, Sanford, Florida, Daytona Beach, in February the 1st. All the guys were in the service were there. And the second or third day we were in camp, we played an inter-squad game. Uh-huh. And, you know, not throwing a baseball for 3 years when I was in the service. Throwing that ball to first base, and all of a sudden I hurt my arm. So they moved me to first base, and I became a first baseman. And then my baseball career continued on.
The Pony League, was that a Class D?
Class D. That's when they had Class D, C, B, A, double A, and triple A.
Yeah, that's right. Now they just, I think
they
C.
They even had an E League at one time, which was like a rookie league. That's going quite a few years back.
And you played with
Olean
in New York.
Yeah.
Where is that?
That's in the southern part. It's south, pretty almost on the border of Pennsylvania. Not very far. We had Radford, Pennsylvania was in the league.
Okay.
And then Jamestown.
So you're in that Jamestown, that Chautauqua area.
Yeah, right there. It's a beautiful area. St. Bonaventure in Olean was a big college there.
Who was your first manager then?
Jake Pittler.
Jake?
A great guy. Jake Pittler. He eventually became a coach with the Brooklyn Dodgers. But they should have never made him a coach because he was one of the finest guys to handle young ball players out of high school. And they promoted him, and they gave him a pension and all that, which he really... Mm-hmm. But he was a great guy to play for because he was a small, cocky guy. Short, played for Cincinnati at some time, probably in the 20s and 30s, and I admired him very much, and we were very close. I'm living in Buffalo, New York. It's only 90 miles to Olean.
Yes.
So when we were going to Hamilton, from Olean to Hamilton, Canada, who was in the league, we stopped at my house, my mother's and father's house, and I think we had only 15 ball players on the team at that time, 16 at the most. And we bedded down in our house. It was a three-bedroom house. The guys slept in the living room, a tiny room, and my mother made dinner for them.
Kind of like a boarding house.
Yeah. And then Jake Pittler took us downtown Buffalo to Shays Buffalo Theater, and we watched the Gehrig story.
Lou Gehrig story with Gary Cooper?
Yeah. He took us and he paid our way in.
See that story?
He had to pay our way in because at that time we were only getting $1 a day meal money.
$1 a day meal money, that's
$1
it.
$1 a day meal money. Yeah, my first salary was $90.
How much you signed for?
$500. $250 when I signed, and $250 if I stayed the whole year. So I got the 500. I got the full
bucks.
500.
I guess it's gone. You still have that?
No. I gave that to my mother.
Okay.
Yeah.
I saw your eyes light up when you mentioned your first manager. I gather that you learned a lot from him that you used later as a manager and coach yourself.
The way he treated us. The way he treated us like, you know, we were his sons. He'd reprimand us if we did something wrong in a nice, easy way. Wouldn't beat us up or anything. In fact, we could have beat him up because he was kind of small. But he took care of us. He watched over us. He wouldn't you know, we had a curfew. He made sure that we ate properly. Olean was a small town.
Now, I'd say after a ball game, there's not much to do.
No, and
you got a lot of time on your hand for young kids.
And he just watched us, you know, and everybody that played for him. I can go back to Stan Rojak, who played with the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Mm-hmm.
He played in Olean, and numerous other guys that eventually went to the major leagues that played for him, and they all had good things to say about him. And I think this is a carryover where it helped me. When I became a minor league manager, that I could kind of talk to the players in a way that I wouldn't hurt their feelings and make them feel kind of at home, because ball players get homesick.
Yeah.
In their early years, you know.
That's right. Here you were 18 years old,
yeah,
playing professional ball. I mean,
First time away from home.
Got a lot of time on your hand.
Yes, pretty much.
I mean, you only write so many letters back home.
The
people in the towns, when you played in the Pony League and in the Texas League, I think, did they? Some people invite you to their homes? Have dinner and talk with you.
This was a big thing. In the smaller towns, you know, like Olean and Abilene, Texas, where I played, people were family oriented so much, and the players, gosh, every day it was come over for dinner. Or lunch, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, that was the most enjoyable part of the baseball at that time.
Does it still go on today in the minor leagues?
No.
Is it permitted, or with a?
Oh, it's permitted. I mean, it goes on, but not as abundantly as it did then.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, hit a home run, and people would stick dollar bills through a screen.
Oh, when you cross home plate, you'd go back there
And just run around by the stands, you know, and hope there was less than two outs so you could go around and get all the money. You know, in 1946, a dollar was a dollar.
You bet. Well, let's see now. In Olean, in 1942, you hit six home runs.
Yeah. We played the football stadium.
You played the football stadium.
Yeah, right where St. Bonaventure played their football. And left field was probably 600 feet, so you didn't hit too many.
No, you didn't. They had a lot of real estate.
And we had a, you know, these are a lot of things you talk about and have fun about now. We had a manager, there was a manager in Hamilton, Canada, that used to put the baseballs in an ice box and freeze the baseball so they wouldn't travel. A frozen ball won't travel very far. And and our man, Jake Finley, used to get so mad. He said, he's freezing these baseballs again. So, you know, home runs, I guess if a guy hit 15 home runs back then, he had a lot of home runs.
Yes, that's right.
And
well, you hit about 250, six home runs, and
I had quite a few extra bases.
Probably, yes, you did.
A third or maybe more than that
of
what I hit.
Mm-hmm.
But the following year, when I got out of the service in 46 is when I made some money because I hit 30-some home runs.
Yeah, you had 31 home runs. You batted .325 with Abilene.
Mm-hmm.
Western Texas?
West Texas, New Mexico League. Uh-huh. Yeah. We traveled in this one of those small, 20-passenger Army buses.
And so you had to do a lot more traveling out in that neck of the woods than you did in upstate New York.
Oh, yeah. We went from Abilene, Texas to Albuquerque, New Mexico.
That's an all-day drive.
Played the next day. So there were no days off. It was only a 140-game schedule, but we played. And the fields we played on in West Texas were all the oil. Is, you know, Lubbock, La Mesa, we've got oil fields all over the place. The field that we played on in Abilene was a skin field. There was no grass. It was oil put on this dirt.
It was put on to keep the dust down.
Keep the dust down. That's it. And we drew...
So you kind of experimented with artificial turf.
Just about. Well, we kept the dust down here because
right.
There's a dust bowl out there.
That's right. Yeah.
That was the beginning of it. And then the next year I played in Fort Worth, Texas. And I broke my ankle but didn't know it. And I was a first baseman. And Les Burge was our manager. I finally healed, and they put me to third base because he was also a first baseman. And I had a pathetic year, really. And the next year, they sold me to St. Paul in 1948, but I only stayed in St. Paul about a month and went back to B-ball, to Newport News, and had a reasonable year there. And to St. Paul in 49, where I stayed, and then I broke my wrist over there. And after that year, I became kind of jack of all trades, and I think Branch Rickey used me for a go here and hope that we can win, because then in night after hitting 309 in 49, I started off the season in 50 in St. Paul, and they sent me to Elmira, the Eastern League, in a Class A, because they were having a bad year over there, and his son-in-law was the general manager. So I went to Elmira and hit real well again. And by the time September rolled around, they called me back to St. Paul.
When you say you were sold to St. Paul now, that was part of the Dodger system. Now, didn't the Dodgers own the St. Paul franchise?
Yes,
or?
But, I mean, your contract had to be sold to someplace.
Okay.
In other words, back then, another team could have drafted me.
That's true.
So, now when I'm going back to the 40s, you know, the 49, 50, and so forth, we had Montreal, the Brooklyn Dodgers at Montreal.
As International League.
International League. And then they had also, they had Hollywood and the Pacific Coast League later on. And
so you had three AAA teams.
Right. So what Branch Rickey used to do is take all the good ball players and put them on the Montreal roster. And he outsmarted himself because Pittsburgh drafted Roberto Clemente off of that.
Oh, really?
And he tried to hide him. He didn't even, he didn't play him very much. He tried to hide Roberto Clemente from the draft because you could only take one player off a club. And by putting all these good players on, he figured, well, he'd lose a player, but he wouldn't use Roberto. And he lost Roberto Clemente to Pittsburgh. And eventually Branch Rickey goes to Pittsburgh and becomes the general manager.
That's right.
So, hanky-panky, I don't know.
I don't know. I didn't.
But he was a wheeler and dealer.
He was really, he brought back the farm system. Someone told me that actually he was the one originated it, although I think it existed before Branch Rickey, the Cardinals.
The Cardinals had it, way back. Well, and I think the Philadelphia A's at that time, too, when Connie Mack had it.
It kind of went downhill, and then he brought it back again.
Well, it had to come back because of the players going into the service. Because at that time, there weren't that many leagues, but we had a lot of ball players, and during the war, the players that didn't go into service were there, and now you've got an abundance of players, and before you know it, I think 48 or something like that. I think the Dodgers had 26 minor league farm teams, and the Cardinals probably had as many. But between the Cardinals and the Dodgers, and then the Yankees,
they
had
theirs.
Their own farm systems.
Yeah, they had three AAA teams in San Francisco and Kansas City and Newark. I remember the
Newark were as good as the Yankees.
That's right. That's true.
Couldn't distinguish one from the other.
What was it, 1940 or thereabouts, that the Yankees played, I think Cincinnati, I'm not sure, in the World Series, and the Newark Bears played the Kansas City Blues in the Little World Series.
That was, I think, that happened in St. Paul and Montreal, too.
Oh, it did?
Yeah.
In the
Two Brooklyn
in the
teams.
In the two Brooklyn teams.
That was in 48, I think.
48.
In 49, I thought Kansas City had Bruce Gowron.
Bob Serve.
Bob Serve.
Jim Delsing.
Delsing. Penna.
Well, they had some power hitters.
They had,
he had some muscle
Andy
up
Andy Carey,
there.
I think, was there the year before, 48. Well, every team in the American Association had some outstanding ballpark. The Cardinals in Columbus.
Columbus Redbirds.
Yeah. Dick Littlefield.
Well, you know, I was looking at some of the players that you had on with on that team. Eric Tipman.
Tipman.
He was a fantastic ball player.
Football player, too.
Oh, was he?
Sure. He's the guy that made the longest kick in the Rose Bowl. He was a great kicker and played for William & Mary, I think.
Oh.
I think it was William & Mary. Or, yeah. He's, in fact, his wife just passed away, and he's not very well. He had a stroke.
Mm-hmm. Does he live here in Florida?
No, no. Mm-hmm. He lives in Virginia.
And Al Brancato?
Yes, he lives in Upper Darby. I see him. I saw him quite a bit when I managed Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. He was my roommate. Mm-hmm.
Don Hoag?
Passed away. Played with Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm. And,
but the whole league, we had Clem LeBine was on.
Clem LeBine was there.
On that team. Phil Hogstead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Phil Hogstead was pitching.
Mm-hmm. Harry Taylor, who went to the Red Sox and pitched with the Red Sox for a while.
You had a kind of small park there in St. Paul, or was that the
short
Minneapolis?
Short left field fence.
Short left field.
Well, it was 315 down the left field line.
Uh-huh.
Minneapolis had the,
they had the
260
band box.
Down the right field line. That's where Mays went up from there. Yeah. And old knuckleballer Hoyt Wilhelm pitched there.
Yeah.
I played against him over there. There was always a, we played it on holidays. We played, St. Paul played Minneapolis on every holiday, 4th of July, Labor Day, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
One game in the morning in St. Paul, the other game in the afternoon in Minneapolis. And then the next time was just reversed.
Mm-hmm.
And we got meal money. We made out real good.
I hope you got more than a dollar
but
a day.
We never stayed in Minneapolis. It was, you know, we'd take a bus and then come back to St. Paul or whatever. And St. Paul had, Minneapolis had some good ballplayers come out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Harshman, who was a home run hitter in that ballpark and became a good pitcher for the White Sox later on. Little things like that. The Louisville team.
Yeah, Louisville Cardinals.
Gosh, they had abundance of good ballplayers come into Walter Tropo, Zouchin.
Mm-hmm.
Pearsall was
there. Picky Higgins was the manager.
Mel Parnell was the manager year, I believe.
Yeah.
Not Mel Parnell. Pinky Higgins was there.
Yes.
There was another one. I can't remember his name.
In the American Association, which you consider the most knowledgeable baseball fans?
What city?
Uh-huh. Oh. Anyone stand out in your mind particularly? You know,
well, I guess probably... Columbus, Indianapolis, probably Kansas City, because they stayed with that particular team, like the Yankees and the Cardinals with Columbus, and Milwaukee was a pretty good knowledgeable team as far as players are concerned, but this is going later on when Nick Culp managed.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They became, George Crow played there, and Billy Bruton, and Buzz Clarkson, and Johnny Logan. My ex-center fielder's father was a catcher there, Del Unser.
Oh, really?
Sure. And Del eventually played for me.
Yeah.
In,
yes.
In Philly.
In Philly, indeed.
There's another association there where I played against Ray Boone when he was at Oklahoma City in the Texas League.
And then he played
for Bobby Boone played for me in Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia.
So it's father and son association there. It's pretty good.
Indeed. Well, you had a few injuries in the minor leagues, wrists, ankles, what have you, bum arm. Did you think then by 1950-51 that coaching and managing was the way to go?
I really didn't.
Or did it just kind of happen gradually, and there wasn't any particular year that you thought, hey, I want to stay in baseball, but I think I better look into coaching?
I think it kind of happened gradually, but it happened when I was in the Texas League in 1950, probably started in 54. Played for Al Vincent.
Mm-hmm.
I was still playing, and then I played for Tommy Holmes. And Tommy Holmes was if he got kicked out of a ball game, he says, you run the team. And then there was an owner of Oklahoma City, Bob Humphreys, who owned the Oklahoma City team, wanted me as a manager that particular year. And they said, no, we're not going to let him go. And I stayed there in Fort Worth and played. And then in 1956, Fresco Thompson called me and asked me if I would like to manage Wichita Falls in the Big State League, which mm-hmm. was a Class B league. Mm-hmm. So I kind of figured, well, heck, I'm finished anyway now. So I told him yes, and I became a playing manager. So I had to make out reports every day on the progress of the game, the progress of the players. Then I had to make another report on the entire league in the middle of the season and at the end of the season. So I had a lot of work to do.
Isn't it almost impossible to be a playing manager?
Oh, yeah. Throw batting practice, play, make out reports, help drive the bus.
Oh, I forgot about driving the bus, but yeah. Did you ever take yourself out for a pinch hitter?
No. This is 1956. We had 16 ball players.
Is all of them on a call?
That's it. I had an extra catcher.
Yeah, you just
that made nine. Uh-huh. And an extra infielder, outfielder, jack of all trades, and maybe five or six pitchers. I had one pitcher that pitched 240 innings for me. We only played 140 games. He was 18 and 18, I believe. Mm-hmm. But this is development.
Yeah.
And we took care of our players.
So kind of tell me.
We finished third in the league. Mm-hmm. And we lost in the playoffs. And then the following year, I went to the 3I leagues and managed Cedar Rapids.
That's Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana?
Yes. Yeah. And I had a bad year there as far as the player, the standings were concerned because it was kind of an independently owned team, but the Dodgers were in there. And it was really a Cleveland Indian farm team that won many, many years. And when we went in there, the Dodgers were bums, you know. Hell, they didn't want us.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a bad year, but I had about five players that developed and went up higher the following year, which was our job. And it turned out pretty good. Then I got promoted to Macon in the Sally League in 1958. I stayed there 58 and 59. In 58, we finished third and won the playoffs and the championship and sent up four players to the major leagues on a roster anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Smith and Carl Warwick, the most notable ones. They did. They played in Major Leagues quite a while. And 1959, we were so-so. In 1960, they promoted me and gave me the St. Paul job mm-hmm. in American Association.
So you were with them really until the disbandment of what we know of as
yes.
the old American Association.
Yes. Yeah. That was the last year.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, nobody knew about this
mm-hmm.
deal. And
how'd you hear about it then?
Well, when the season ended,
mm-hmm.
They said, you know, we're moving out, and Minneapolis is becoming a major league franchise. It's going to be Minneapolis, St. Paul,
yeah.
Minnesota Twins eventually. So they moved me to Omaha. And I managed there for 2 years, which was an American Association.
That's right.
But it was, you know, Omaha and different cities. It wasn't the same.
Yeah.
But it was still American Association. And did well over there. I got some good ball players, and our teams progressed very well. And then I went to the Pacific Coast League, Spokane, Washington, and managed for 2 years there, 63 and 64. 63, we won the whole thing. 64, we did fairly decent, but didn't do anything. And then 65, Buzzy Bavese called me up and asked me if I'd like to be a coach in a Los Angeles Dodgers team.
Okay, that was in the mid-60s then, I guess, 64, 65.
Yeah, very fortunate because in 65 we won the World Series.
That's right.
Won the whole ball of wax. In 66, we lost to Baltimore in four straight games.
Yeah.
And then there was a big transition. Sandy Koufax retired. There was a lot of things that happened. And the Dodgers were on the way down for quite a few years. And finally, about 72, we started coming up.
Yeah.
72, I left the Dodgers and went to the Phillies. In a great disappointment with my dad. My dad couldn't see me going. He was a bum. You know, he was a Brooklyn Dodger bum. He said, "Why are you going?" You know, and all this. And unfortunately, the day I got my job in Philadelphia, my dad passed away on that same day. November the 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
He passed away, and he never knew that I accepted the job, really. I told him I was going to, but it was not official.
It was not official.
So then my managerial in the major leagues became official then.
Yeah.
And had great, I had a wonderful time in Philadelphia for 7 years.
I read a story, and I was fresh in your mind now, and then go back to a fellow that you had mentioned before we started the interview, Fresco Thompson. I heard you seem to be kind of a mellow, relaxed kind of person in the few minutes I've had a chance to meet you, and I heard that players took advantage of you that first year with the Phillies, and they were darn near in rebellion.
They thought they were taking advantage of me because there were some people on there that I didn't admire very much as players because of their personal habits. Not on the field, off the field.
Yes.
They were not professional as far as I was concerned. And as I got to weed them out, naturally I made more enemies, which didn't bother me any because the players I got rid of didn't hook up with too many other teams. So we cleaned those out and eventually became respectable. In 74, we moved up a notch. In 75, we moved up a notch. And eventually in 76, we won the whole.
Yeah, you won the three Eastern Division titles.
That's right. When you're a manager and you have to make decisions about who's to stay and whose feelings am I going to hurt, you're going to create enemies, ill feelings by other people. And it happened, and it disturbed me slightly, but not as much as a few other incidents that I had in Philadelphia.
Philadelphia sports writers can be a tough bunch of characters, like the New York sports writers.
They're tough.
But how do you educate baseball writers to ask intelligent questions?
You don't.
You don't? No. You don't even think about it?
I think, you know, the Philadelphia writers were fine. There were a lot of them that kind of thought they knew baseball. And didn't ask questions about the game. They asked questions about things they shouldn't know about. There might be personal questions about somebody. The thing that really bothers you, and where it got to the point in '76, '77, one writer comes in and asks you a question. Another writer comes in a little bit later and changes the question a little bit, but it's the same question, wanting a different answer. It became to the point where they wanted controversial things and not baseball facts.
They wanted something for some kind of headline.
Yeah, the controversy. They want controversy. This guy's a bum. Say something, you know, that's going to start some excitement.
Yeah.
Which wasn't, I didn't like it. I didn't in any way ridicule any ballplayers. Didn't show them up in any way, and that they wanted that, and they didn't get it. So
sometimes they go around inventing it. Then
so we had a vendetta there for a while. But they said I was going to punch somebody in the mouth and stuff. stuff like that, mm-hmm. which I closed my door and didn't allow anybody in my office.
Mm-hmm.
But we became pretty good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I think right now, a lot of them understand me more than they did before.
Mm-hmm.
And there's only a few left. But the guy that I got to know the best probably was Frank Dolson and, mm-hmm. and Ray Kelly. And then eventually Bill Conlon, who was... I sold a lot of the newspapers for Bill Conlon.
You sold a lot of newspapers?
Yes.
By some of your one-liners or your quotes?
Yeah. I started off in, you know, in 73. I started off in somewhere along the line. Everybody was... At that time, the Mets had won. I mean, they won the thing. But they were 80 and 82, or 82 and 80.
Mm-hmm.
And this was... pretty much in the early part of the season, I said, well, you could throw a blanket over all these teams. And that became a thing in their newspaper where the blanket issue, it was, you know, and it became, you know, eventually the truth, because we finished sixth, but we weren't that far out of first place. Mm-hmm. And the Mets finished with an 82 and 80, I think. And they won the thing. And they weren't that good either. Okay. I mean, it was kind of a... And then they go ahead and go into the World Series. Mm-hmm. And they... This thing became something in the paper. Everybody looked for the blanket, you know. Mm-hmm. Throw a blanket.
Well, I can see that living in Philadelphia a while where that would sell a few papers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it, there were a lot of other things that happened. But I enjoyed myself a lot. I have a lot of friends there. All the writers there I know very well, and we've become good friends.
Going back to Thompson, mm-hmm. you mentioned him a couple of times, and what I sense is that in no small measure, he really shaped a lot of your thinking about baseball.
He was probably more instrumental in the phases of baseball, the game itself. How to handle players, how to handle situations, teaching. He was a disciplinarian to the point, if we can do it all the same way, which is a branch of Ricky theory too, let's have everybody do it the same way, so we don't
now,
have
what do you
to
mean
change.
By doing that same way?
Your pickoff plays, your cutoff relays, different things that a team should do as one,
mm-hmm.
rather than individually.
Mm-hmm.
So if we do promote a player from Double A to the major leagues, we don't have to teach that player the cutoffs, relays, the pickoff plays when he gets here. We all have the same pickoff plays. It's ABCs, and mm-hmm. stay with the ABCs rather than I'll teach you ABCs and the next guy's going to teach you P's and Q's.
Q's.
So he was that guy there, and he was on a rules committee. He knew all the rules, and by him talking about these things, I used to read the rule book every day, five or six rules, and mm-hmm. just read them. And I did that all the time. That I knew the rules as well as anybody, mm-hmm. and reading the rule book is. Not the easiest thing in the world
no,
to
it
understand.
Isn't. I have a copy at home, and
yeah.
you need to fall asleep after a few minutes.
Yeah, and you have to get situations and think of situations before you can adapt that rule to that situation.
Well, so, how'd that help you? I mean, is that second-guessing the umpire rather than teaching baseball players the basics?
Yeah. No, that's teaching. Because I made my ball player sit down with me during the season, and I read the rules to them. I wanted them to be aware of the rules. That they, when they went on that field, if something should happen, that they would, if they had an argument with an umpire, that they had an idea what they were arguing about. By the time I got to the umpire, and then probably rephrase it and give them the exact rule of what it should be. I won a few rule. I won a few arguments that helped us win a few ball games, because not that the umpire didn't know the rule.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't too sure, and he had to confer with other umpires. and they changed us one time in Philadelphia. I know it happened when I was coaching for Walter Alston.
What's that?
And Gene Mock was managing the Phillies at that time. There was a throw from the outfield, and we had the...
Was that 64 Phillies when the...
No, this was later on. This is probably 66, somewhere in there. And the rule says, if I can remember it correctly, if a throw from the outfielder to another one, a second throw, and the ball should go in and dug out in the stands, you're allowed two bases.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the umpire disagreed, you know. And Walter Alston was out there in Oregon, and I called Doug Harvey, who was umpiring that time, and he was umpiring the base. And I said, Doug, I said, remember, if it's handled by another player, it's a second throw and so forth. So he went in there and he called the umpires and he told them about it. And they allowed two runs to score rather than just one because the ball had gone in the dugout. And Gene Mock was sitting there in his dugout, and he knows the rules too.
Uh-huh.
And he looked around, and he took one step out of the dugout and went back in the dugout. And I looked at him, and he started laughing. Because he knew darn well that we were right. And it was just... But this is why a lot of things that happen on the field, even today, I watch games today, and things happen on that field that players argue about it, but don't know why they're arguing about it. Because they don't know the rule, number one.
And so it gets personal rather than the policy or the rules of the game.
If you can remember situations, I remember a situation. I wasn't involved in this, but another National League club was involved in it. Strike three, bases loaded, 3-2 count, and the catcher misses the ball. And the runner doesn't run to first base. They're standing there. The batter, I should say.
Why?
And the catcher picks the ball up as it rolls by the catcher, and he takes it and throws it into right field. That batter is not out.
Of course not.
But the catcher threw the ball into right field. Three runs scored, and they finally convinced the guy that was batting to go to first base. And
what
he's safe.
Trying to convince the guy to go to first base.
Because he didn't realize that the catcher has to either tag him,
sure,
or throw the ball to first base.
They don't know that.
Well, they didn't know it. It was the same thing with when they made the balk rule. And this guy balks, but he throws the ball to first base and throws it over to first baseman's head.
Mm-hmm.
That ball is in play.
Yes.
You run at your own peril. But a lot of players didn't know that. They would stop at second base and say, yeah, I got second base.
Kind of eat lunch and the ball's in play.
Sure. He could have went to third.
He might have gone to home.
Yeah, and maybe the right fielder didn't know the rule either, so he never moved after the ball.
Yeah. He figured the balk was called, the ball's dead.
That's why when you talk about Fresco Thompson and the rules and all this, and why I read the rules and why I continue to rule, and why I read the rules to the players, not all of them, but basically all the ones that...
So you would read or maybe... couple of rules and then give a couple of situations where that rule is applicable.
Yeah. We used to have, he would bring out a piece of paper with questions on it in spring training. Say, okay, guys, answer these questions.
A little quiz, like a teacher.
Yeah. And see if you know the darn rules. And if you don't know, well, we'll teach them to you. And it more so became a thing that, you know, when we got more Spanish players, like Washington had all the Cuban players,
yeah.
And they, gosh, how do you talk to these guys?
Yeah.
So you got to get an interpreter. I walked out to the mound in New York with Tony Taylor when I had a Mexican pitcher because I couldn't speak Spanish.
Yeah, bring Tony along to translate.
Yeah, I told the umpire, I'm just bringing him to translate. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. So. Managing is not the easiest thing in the world. It's a lot of fun, but you got to buy a psychologist and a mother and a father and everything else.
Well, you know, I read a book about managers saying the darndest things.
Yeah.
Says Maury Wills said, people think it's easy, but it isn't. Managing is a lonely, difficult job. It's not fun. It's a nightmare, but I enjoy it.
That's about me. He said what he felt. You enjoy it when the game starts. Prior to the game, it's no fun. After the game, it's no fun. When the game starts, it's fun.
Why isn't it before the game?
Because you got to put up with all this other garbage. People coming in and asking you questions.
Players?
No.
What do you mean?
Media. No. Mostly media. Television, what? Interviews. They interfere with the players' workouts.
Oh, I see. During batting practice, yeah. And all that, yeah. When they're out there. Yeah. Okay.
Shoot, when I got Dick Allen back in Philadelphia, we're in Chicago, mm-hmm. where he had finished playing with the White Sox, really.
Yeah.
He was traded to Atlanta, yes. You know, mm-hmm. whatever. They've got to have 100 writers out there with television cameras mm-hmm. and tape recorders and everything, and they all want to talk to him. And so I take him, and I walk to first base with him, and at first base, and all these writers are lined up like, you know, we're giving something away. And this guy, you know, is a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a publicity guy. Everybody wants to know why he's doing this and mm-hmm. why he's doing that. You know, it was that way in almost every city. You try to protect the guy, but this before the game.
Yeah.
After the game, it's just as bad.
Can't you, couldn't you just say off the field?
Yeah,
the media.
Yeah, you can ask. You can't run them off the field, no. No. You can't keep them.
Gee, I've saw him play a few times. This is side two of tape number one with Dan Ozark. Richie Allen, tremendous talent.
Absolutely.
I mean, God gave that man, and half the time, I know I'm exaggerating, he wouldn't show up for spring training, and then the opening day hit a home run.
He, great physique, outstanding instincts. The best base runner I ever had. The guy... He never got thrown out of home plate from second base. Never. He gave you a steady gait. He was just fantastic. Outstanding hitter. He swung a Babe Ruth type of bat, 42 ounces or maybe even heavier.